people are seeing the financial toll of COVID-19 when they look at their bank accounts. And city leaders, they're experiencing money woes too. As people spend less money, local governments get a smaller cut of the taxes. Pair that with people struggling to pay property taxes, and municipal leaders face difficult decisions with city budgets. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. There's room for you in this discussion. 800-642-1234. What services would you be willing to give up if your community doesn't have enough money? What's non-negotiable and a top priority for you when it comes to those public dollars? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Andrew Ushefsky is Professor Emeritus of Public Affairs and Applied Economics at UW-Madison's Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs. He's published widely on topics related to state and local government finance. Andrew, thanks for being with us on the Ideas Network.
I'm glad to be with you.
Municipal governments around the country are working on their budgets for next year. You've got a paper about to come out about city governments that are going to have less money to work with. How bad does it look for municipalities?
It looks quite bad. What we studied were 150 of the nation's largest central cities, and they include Madison and Milwaukee within Wisconsin. And among our 150 cities, we project for next fiscal year, we're already in the fiscal year 2021, cuts that are from between 5.5% to 9%, which in dollar terms turn out to be about between $34 and $55 billion.
And
those
that's
are big numbers.
Big numbers because of the pandemic.
These are because of the pandemic. What we did basically is ask, what would revenue have been in these cities in 2021 if there hadn't been a pandemic? And then go source by source and say, what are the likely declines in revenue, shortfalls in revenue for each source? And then we add them up. So it's an exercise that just looks at the impact of the pandemic, both the disease and then the economic fallout.
To really understand why this is happening, we have to figure out how cities are actually funded. What's the general process for getting tax dollars into a city so that they can use the money for public good?
So among these 150 cities, there are really 150 different stories. The mix of revenue sources varies a lot across the country, but in general, all cities use property tax. And then many cities use other sorts of local taxes. In 114 of the cities, although not in Madison and Milwaukee, there's a sales tax, local sales tax, sometimes local income taxes. And then there are a set of fees, user charges and fees that people pay for various services, and some other miscellaneous sorts of revenue. Those are revenues raised by city governments and the overlying governments, school districts, and so forth, that serve city residents. And then there's money from federal government and from state government in the form of state aid and federal aid.
With so many different sources, then, it seems like maybe there's an opportunity if one source dips, but if they're all down, that could be a challenge. Which revenue streams are taking the biggest hit in this pandemic?
Let me flip around your question a little bit and emphasize the revenue stream that's likely to be the most stable and not likely to fall, and that's the property tax. And that in part reflects two things, but in part reflects that the property tax is a tax that's administered. You pay your tax on your assessed value. It takes a year or two for changes in market values that would get reflected in assessed value, and then your property tax bill this year is based on last year's assessed value. And that means that this year, this coming year, even if market values start declining, and that's an if, it's not going to be reflected in tax revenues. And so places like particularly Madison, and Milwaukee and most jurisdictions within the state of Wisconsin rely very heavily on the property tax relative to other cities around the country. And that means they're in a little better position than many other places that rely on taxes like sales, local sales taxes, which have plummeted in many places, and income taxes.
Andrew Reshofsky is Professor Emeritus of Public Affairs and Applied Economics at UW-Madison School of Public Affairs. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234 as we talk about city budgets and how they are suffering in this pandemic. And we're taking your calls, again, that number 800-642-1234. Maybe you work as a city official and you're seeing how the pandemic and this recession have affected revenue. Maybe you are living in a city or near a city and you want tax dollars spent in a certain way. How are you making sure your elected officials know what your priorities are when they're looking at cutting their budgets? 800-642-1234. Andrew, on the property tax track, though, although it is the most stable, there are people who've lost their jobs during the pandemic who might struggle to pay those property taxes. Will cities see people who can't pay?
I think they will see some people who can't pay, a relatively small number. And how can I say that? Our analysis has been based to some degree on what happened in the Great Recession, where there were big cuts in housing prices, when people were losing their houses. And in a few cities, you had what are called property tax delinquencies, people not being able to pay. But in most cities, they were relatively small. And that's in part because a lot of people pay their property tax through their mortgage payments, and the banks may actually continue paying the property tax even if someone is falling behind a little on their mortgage. So yes, that'll have an impact, and we built that into our projections, but a relatively small one. Now, if things go on, we're talking about 2 years from now, 3 years from now, particularly if property values fall, then the impact on cities in terms of falling property taxes and property tax revenues will be much greater. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned you looked at 150 cities around the country. Which ones appear to be in the worst position to deal with this drop in revenue?
So it turns out near the top are cities in New York State, Buffalo and Syracuse, Rochester, for instance, large cities, and to a somewhat lesser degree, New York City. And that reflects the story there is that those cities rely very heavily on state aid. And we project that state aid in New York State will decline more than average, in part reflecting the fact that New York State doesn't have much of a rainy day fund compared with many other states. And so that gets reflected in, and again, we draw on our experience from the Great Recession, where there were big cuts in state aid, including education aid, across the country. And that's going to be one part of the story this year.
One part of many. We're talking with Andrew Reshofsky, who's Professor Emeritus of Public Affairs and Applied Economics at UW-Madison's Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs. And we've got a line for you at 800-642-1234 as we talk about what city budgets will look like as the recession affects their situation, as the numbers don't quite add up because of the coronavirus pandemic's effects. How is your city planning to cope with a drop in revenue expected from the pandemic? Do you hear your elected officials talking about this now? Do you know what they expect to cut first and what services are absolutely essential? What do you think? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. I'm Keely Boltina. This conversation continues here on The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. City budgets are not immune to the financial fallout of a pandemic. Wisconsin's two largest cities are set to lose millions of dollars in revenue next year, and that's millions that can't go into public services and supports. I'm Keely Boltina. Our guest, Andrew Reshofsky, has published widely on topics related to state and local government finance. And we're taking your calls, your questions, your priorities for your community at 800-642-1234. There's a line for you to ask your question or share your story, 800-642-1234. We've got Jim from Dubuque, Iowa on the line now. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I think a lot of these cities' problems have been exacerbated by the COVID, but they were already in an impossible situation where you have many public employees retiring as multi-millionaires because an average person would have to have $6 or $8 million in the bank in order to get the kind of guaranteed pensions that they are being given. That needs to be renegotiated.
Jim, thanks for that perspective. Andrew, how big of an issue are pensions in these city budgets you're looking at?
Pensions are a part of city expenditures. I don't have knowledge about in explicitly what share of the spending each year goes to pensions, but in most cities, it's a relatively small share as employees put money into the pensions. And in Wisconsin, we have a very good system of a pension system, which is not in deficit. So I think pensions have play a very small role in, and certainly no role in, the current problems caused by the pandemic.
All right. Jim, thanks for calling at 800-642-1234. There's a line for you as we talk about municipal budgets here with our guest. And Andrew, let's talk more about those two Wisconsin cities that your paper includes. That's Madison and Milwaukee. Tell us more about the situations they're facing.
What we did was looked at two assumptions, one more severe and one less severe. And we'll start with Madison. Madison, we project a decline in revenue of 6.6%, which is close to $86 million. And in Milwaukee, a larger decline of 8.8% in revenue, again, in the next year, in 2021. And that's close to $273 million. So quite large. And I just could add that Madison, in some sense, has a smaller decline, below average decline, because of its heavy reliance on the property tax relative to most cities in the country.
Well, some Wisconsin cities, thinking Wisconsin Dells or Sturgeon Bay, they're big tourist attractions. You don't evaluate those cities in this analysis, but could they also be in trouble?
I think the answer is to some extent, yes. And we do, in our sample, evaluate places like Las Vegas and Orlando, and they get hit very hard. They have across the 150 cities, they're up there in terms of the largest reductions. Now, in Wisconsin, county governments that serve city residents have a 0.5% sales tax. And those sales tax revenues are going to be down, particularly in those communities. But to the extent that they rely on the property tax, they won't be hurt as much as in Orlando, for example.
Well, as cities begin to feel the pinch from these declining revenues, I mean, what options do they really have?
Cities basically and school districts, local governments in Wisconsin and around the country face balanced budget requirements. And some of them have some reserve funds and some have more, some have less. But to the extent, these are big revenue declines, and that almost assures that there'll need to be spending declines. And there's one big proviso. The federal government could increase funding to local governments, state and local governments, and help close some of these shortfalls, these gaps. And whether they will do that is anyone's guess.
Andrew Ruschowski is Professor Emeritus of Public Affairs and Applied Economics at UW-Madison's Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Still time for a question if you're wondering how city budgets work and how they can be affected by this pandemic, by the fallout of the coronavirus. 800-642-1234. Tell us what's a priority for you and what you see happening in your community. Andrew, relying on Congress, different people might place different bets there. So what services do you see cities cutting first if Congress doesn't approve aid?
Well, obviously, the decisions on what gets cut are going to be made at the local levels. And these are when we talk about cities in our analysis, we're talking about the municipal government plus the overlying government. So the school district, in Madison's case, Madison Metropolitan School District, or Milwaukee, the Milwaukee School District, which are really separate government bodies. And their budgets are going to go down, too. And Dane County's budget in Madison and Milwaukee County budgets are going to go down. And so all of them will face pressure. And so we're likely to see cuts in education spending, cuts in social welfare, mental health expenditures that county governments do, and maybe cuts in public safety even that are a big responsibility of municipal governments. And you might ask, how can they possibly cut public safety? But if they have less money and a lot of the budget of a municipal government goes to police and fire, something has to give. And in some cases, that it's going to mean reductions in spending and in services.
How long could these revenue shortfalls right now affect the long-term fiscal health of our cities?
They could have an impact. Our experience in the Great Recession was that even though the Great Recession lasted a couple of years, it was over in officially over in 2009, revenues of a lot of cities kept on declining for four more years until 2013. And I don't think that will happen this time, but no one really knows. And if, as a response to the COVID-19, people start saying, we don't want to live in cities anymore, or companies say, we don't want to have offices anymore, people can work from home, then there's going to be less demand for property within cities, within central cities. That could lower market values over the next couple of years. And so 3-4 years from now, there could be decline in property tax revenue that could really hurt the cities. It suggests that there is a possibility, and we don't know this for a fact, but that there could be a long tail to this to the fiscal impacts of this COVID-19 pandemic.
You mentioned cities being constrained by balanced budgets, meaning they have to spend what they have and not all allow for borrowing. In Wisconsin, could the legislature provide more aid to support cities?
Absolutely, they could, but we have to think about how the state, where their money comes from. Their money comes from tax revenue to a large extent, income taxes and sales taxes, and state tax revenues are going to be down too. Now, nothing stops the legislature from saying it's essential that we maintain these services. And so we're going to raise the level of taxation. Will they do that? Asking the question probably provides the answer in the Wisconsin context. Very unlikely. And that means if there's less money, if there's a budget gap at the state level, the state could still say, we're going to cut everything out of the university budget and our own expenditures and save state aid to education. But again, past experience suggests that there'll be cuts both in state services, like the UW system, and in aid to schools and to local governments.
We're scraping for the silver lining here, Andrew. Are there any upsides for city officials with this downturn?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure there are really upsides because, we haven't mentioned yet, there are going to be higher costs. And now everybody's thinking about the opening of schools. Schools have to figure out how to operate in this really complex environment to make things safe, to have retrofitted air filtration systems. Those don't come cheaply. So there's sort of higher costs at the same time when the revenue is going to decline. So I don't see a lot of silver lining.
All right. Well, you tried. I appreciate it, Andrew. This has been a really enlightening conversation. Thank you for your time today.
Sure. My pleasure. Thank you.
Andrew Ruschowski is Professor Emeritus of Public Affairs and Applied Economics at UW-Madison's Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs. He's been published widely on topics related to state and local government finance, and we've been talking about the changes we're likely to see in city budgets because of the fallout of the new coronavirus pandemic. Up next is news. Then demonstrators are protesting racial injustice and police brutality. That's in the wake of Kenosha police shooting a black man named Jacob Blake on Sunday. We're talking about the latest developments after protesters again took to the streets. It's happening here on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and this is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Join us tonight at 8 for live NPR coverage of the Republican National Convention. We bring you a mix of live and virtual events that are planned as delegates confirm Donald Trump as the party's candidate for president. That's tonight through Thursday night, starting at 8 o'clock on Wisconsin Public Radio. You can also view it online at WPR.org. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. Protesters gathered in Kenosha and Madison for another night of demonstrations against racial injustice. They clashed with law enforcement. Earlier in the afternoon, Jacob Blake's attorney and family talked about the extent of his injuries. Kenosha police shot Blake, a black man, on Sunday evening. Video of it and the story have made international headlines. Were you in Kenosha or Madison last night? Were you in a different community with demonstrations? What did you see and hear? Are you protesting police brutality or racial injustice? How do we do better? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Rachel Vasquez is a Wisconsin Public Radio reporter and producer. She's been up all night covering what's happening, and she joins us for an update. Rachel, good morning.
Hey, Keely.
We now know that shootings last night are related to the protests, counter-protests happening in Kenosha. What information do we have so far?
Yeah, that's right. So we know from the Kenosha Police Department that two people have died. Three people total were shot. Two are dead as of last night, and one person is injured. That one person who is injured had serious but not life-threatening injuries. But it was a tragic turn to a protest that was chaotic at times. Peaceful earlier in the evening, but certainly turned chaotic a little bit later at night. What we know, though, about at least one of the deaths that occurred, we know that it was a male. Kenosha Sheriff David Beth told Kenosha News that it was a male, but he doesn't know if the person who died was an adult. And one other interesting thing that we know about the deaths is that Sheriff David Beth told the New York Times that the investigation was focused on a group of civilians who showed up at the protest armed, who were there to protect private property. They were trying to prevent things like looting.
Certainly things are developing very quickly, so we'll pay attention to what happens there. Last night you were in Kenosha as protesters gathered and marched. You mentioned that situation became violent. What happened? Who threw or used what?
Right. And I guess I want to say, too, that the protests initially were peaceful. There was one group of protesters early on in the evening who started marching around 6 o'clock. It was a group of about 100 protesters who started by the county courthouse. They marched all kind of throughout the city, and then they returned to the courthouse around 8 p.m., which was the countywide curfew time. And when protesters got back to the courthouse with that initial group, the organizers really urged a lot of the people who were there and following them to go home, to respect the curfew. And certainly a lot of them did. Some of them stayed and just kind of hung out to see what was going to happen next. And what happened next was, a little bit after the curfew, a separate group of protesters came to the county courthouse and were marching. Those protesters ended up doing things like throwing fireworks at law enforcement. They also threw glass bottles, water bottles. So certainly a different tone for that later group of protesters.
And officials responded with force.
Right, that's right. Law enforcement used tear gas, a lot of tear gas. They fired canisters out for hours trying to clear protesters. They used pretty large military-style vehicles to also clear protesters. They would drive them up onto the grass where protesters were standing to clear them out. And the whole process took a long time. It took hours, and it wasn't done when my colleague and I left around 11:30.
Yeah, things kept happening, kept developing. When you were there, what were you hearing from protesters, or what did you see on their signs?
I heard a few things. The protesters, the organizers who spoke earlier on, had a pretty clear list of things that they wanted to come out of the protest. They said that they wanted the local district attorney to fire the officer who was involved in the shooting of Jacob Blake, and they wanted the DA to press charges against him. They wanted a community review board for Kenosha Police Department. They want some kind of body to be able to raise objections or have some kind of oversight over a police department that a lot of people in that community say have, you know, been targeting communities of color. And past that, they had a similar demand that you've heard in lots of protests about racial justice in recent months. A lot of them were calling to defund the police.
Yesterday, Governor Tony Evers declared a state of emergency, deployed the National Guard to Kenosha County after earlier protests left businesses vandalized. What did you see as far as the law enforcement presence there last night?
There was a lot of law enforcement out. Initially, it didn't appear to be that many. They were hanging back for the first part of that later protest. I would say I started seeing them maybe around 8:30 or 9 o'clock. And by the time they came out, they were maybe 50 or 60 that were lining up in front of the Kenosha County Courthouse in full riot gear, standing in front of it in a line to make sure that protesters didn't try to tear down a fence that was acting as a barrier between the protesters and the courthouse. And as the night went on and it became harder and harder to get protesters to clear the area, you saw more and more law enforcement come out. We saw lots of different uniforms. It looked like National Guard was out, local county law enforcement, as well as local law enforcement. We know that law enforcement from surrounding communities came to help out. So there was a lot of law enforcement on the scene to try to get a handle on the situation last night.
Rachel Vasquez is a Wisconsin Public Radio reporter and producer who's been covering the shooting along with our team of Jacob Blake and the aftermath in Kenosha. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Rachel, both Jacob Blake's father and attorney have shared with the public that the shooting has left Jacob paralyzed from the waist down. What have they talked about when it comes to his situation?
I heard a lot of outrage from protesters yesterday, outrage directed at law enforcement when law enforcement would try to clear out protesters. A lot of them would scream back at them that one of their own had shot this man, Jacob Blake, in the back several times. And how was that justified? So it was certainly something that protesters brought up a lot throughout the night. In addition to the fact that that reportedly his three sons were in the car with him and saw that. So it's certainly top of mind for a lot of people who were out there protesting. And I think there's a lot of people who are upset about it and who are disgusted by it.
A candlelight vigil in Kenosha was scheduled last night for Jacob Blake, but it was moved to Friday. Why did organizers change it?
Yeah, that's right. So that is related to the group of civilians, these private citizens who came to the protests, who were armed with weapons, with firearms, who were there saying that they wanted to protect private property, wanted to prevent looting from happening to local businesses. And I think that organizers of the vigil wanted to make sure that that event wasn't in any way overshadowed by or, you know, put in the middle of a fight with those people who, you know, in their mind might have been stirring up trouble. So that vigil was rescheduled for Friday. And when I was hearing organizers talking about that kind of stuff, that the fact that there were people there who, you know, maybe you would call them counter protesters or just people who weren't necessarily supportive of the Black Lives Matter protesters' agenda. That was something that was very top of mind for the organizers that I spoke to. They all were trying to avoid conflicts with those people as much as possible.
Before we let you go, you've also been covering a group of Milwaukee activists who are marching to Washington, D.C. They were shot at?
That's right. Yeah, it's a kind of shocking story, but and related because it's all, you know, touching on racial injustice and Black Lives Matter. But this group of Milwaukee protesters, activists are on a march to Washington, D.C. So an 800-mile journey across the country. And they were crossing through rural Pennsylvania, Bedford County, Pennsylvania, when they were shot at by someone who wanted them to leave. And there's a little bit of confusion about whether Black Lives Matter protesters from Milwaukee returned fire to the person who shot at them. It's a shocking story happening as they make their way across the country.
Rachel, thank you for updating us on all fronts on this story. We appreciate it.
Sure thing. Thanks, Keely.
Rachel Vasquez is Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter, one of whom has been covering the shooting of Jacob Blake and the aftermath in Kenosha. You can find more updates at WPR.org. Up next here on the Ideas Network, we're talking about disinformation during the election. It's happening here in Wisconsin through memes and sock puppet accounts and more. We've got details just ahead. I'm Keely Boltina. This is the Ideas Network. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. Thanks for being with us here on the Ideas Network. Lies and conspiracy theories are spreading as bad actors try to undermine our democratic process. It's happening here in Wisconsin, especially online. Max Witinski recently graduated from UW-Madison with a master's degree in journalism, and he reported about disinformation for Wisconsin Watch. Last week, I talked to him about what he found. So misinformation and disinformation, those are different. Misinformation refers to mistakes that happen or inaccurate information, but disinformation is intentional?
That's right. So misinformation can be the result of disinformation. If there's a bad actor online who's spreading a message that they know to be false, but then someone else sees it and thinks, oh my gosh, I need to alert other people to this problem. But they don't realize that it's fake, then it becomes misinformation.
Gotcha. So disinformation has this intent that it's fabricated or deliberately manipulated.
That's right.
So how do we know people in our state are targets of disinformation campaigns?
We know for a couple of reasons. One is because of research done at the University of Wisconsin-Madison by Professor Youngmi Kim, and who's a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice, who has studied disinformation on social media pretty widely. We also know because of research that was cited in the Mueller report on election interference by Josephine Lucido, who's a recent graduate from the UWJ school. And then we also know just from looking online and seeing disinformation, it's pretty widespread, and Wisconsin has been specifically targeted by some of the foreign actors like Russia because it's a swing state. So disinformation, unfortunately, is pretty common on news feeds on Facebook and Instagram across the state.
And we know there are many different ways to spread disinformation. Memes are one of them. What's a meme again? How do people make them?
So a meme is just an image with text pasted across it. Usually they're intended to be funny, but they can also have malicious intent. And oftentimes it's kind of a subtle combination, which is what we usually see with disinformation. So maybe a meme making fun of Joe Biden, that's the example that we used in our article. But at the same time, it kind of implies that he has dementia.
Tell us more about that. What did it look like?
So the meme is just a picture of Biden. It's actually captured from his campaign announcement video. And the text is, "I'm Joe Biden and I forgot this message," which kind of makes you laugh because it calls to mind, you know, what people say at the end of a campaign announcement video, which is, "I'm Joe Biden and I approve this message." But if you look in the top right corner, you can see it has a little watermark from this group, Americans for Liberty 76, which is kind of a shady group on Facebook. They don't provide a lot of context for their messaging. And one of their major goals, it seems like, is to kind of stir up emotions, kind of get partisans riled up, essentially. And sowing division in and of itself is one of the big goals.
And we should note, Joe Biden never said that. That's not a circumstance. There's no evidence that he has dementia. But this thing that was supposed to be funny kind of still leaves you with this mistruth lingering in the back of your head.
Right, exactly. So maybe even if you like Joe Biden, you might have second thoughts like, oh, well, maybe he's not actually as fit for the presidency as I think he is. Maybe someone else would have a better candidate. Your enthusiasm for him is a little bit lower. And maybe if millions of people see a message like that, or thousands of messages like that are out there in the media stream, you might actually get lower turnout.
Yeah, even when none of it is true. We're talking with Matt Witinsky, who's written about disinformation for Wisconsin Watch. People looking to undermine our trust in government are targeting people in Wisconsin, especially when it comes to politics. This is the Ideas Network. Max, whose responsibility is this? What have you found?
So I think the responsibility falls to a number of people. One would be obviously the social media companies, who need to do a better job kind of policing their own platforms. Some of the onus, though, to take action is also on us as social media users and as citizens, just to call out this information when we see it, tell our friends to be really cautious and, you know, take everything that they see on social media with a grain of salt, and refer to trusted media that's fact-checked.
And we've seen some inappropriate, untrue attacks on the media. And yet, in this case, media outlets are also responsible for context. You use an example of a tweet from President Donald Trump.
That's right. President Trump, throughout his presidency, I would say, but especially recently, has been seeking to undermine confidence in the fall 2020 election, especially as it pertains to mail-in voting. And this is largely disinformation. the Postal Service is pretty well equipped to handle mail-in ballots. It's something that they've been doing for years. Some states actually vote entirely by mail, like Colorado and Utah. And people really should have confidence that their ballots will be counted. What they do need to do is carefully follow the steps that are put out by the elections commissions in their states. So they need to request the ballots early. They need to get the witness signature, and they need to return them such that clerks will have enough time to process them. But fraud is actually really rare.
You mentioned sock puppet accounts. What are those?
So a sock puppet, in the context that we discuss it in the article, is usually a Russian actor impersonating an American. So some of these accounts during the 2016 election cycle actually garnered thousands and thousands of followers. Basically, people expressing really patriotic views and usually support for things like the Second Amendment, President Trump sometimes. In reality, they weren't based in the U.S. at all, and they were just trying to tip the balance of the election.
So with so many different ways that people are trying to spread lies to us, how are we supposed to go about this? I think I remember one of the examples one of your experts said was just try to look past it online. That's hard to do.
Yeah, it is hard to do. I think fortunately, we still have a pretty robust election infrastructure, especially in Wisconsin. So if people are paying attention to media that's fact-checked, like Wisconsin Watch, like Wisconsin Public Radio, and I think talking with one another also, and not just becoming kind of siloed in their information bubbles, I think there's a good chance that we can have a free and fair election with good participation.
Max, thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.
That was reporter Max Witinski. We discussed how false information aimed at causing harm is making its way to people here in Wisconsin. This Wisconsin Watch piece is part of the Narrow Margin Project. It's investigating voting security, suppression, and disinformation in Wisconsin during this 2020 election season. You can read the full article by Max Witinski and Jessica Christopher online. We've set up a link to it at our website. Just go to WPR.org/warnings. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Join us tonight at 8 o'clock for live NPR coverage of the Republican National Convention. We bring you the mix of live and virtual events planned as delegates confirm Donald Trump as the party's candidate for president. It's the week after the Democratic National Convention. So tune in to the RNC tonight. That is through Thursday, starting at 8 o'clock here on Wisconsin Public Radio and online at WPR.org. Coming up next on The Morning Show, people considering higher education have a different path to college or tech school or a certificate program than before. And admissions departments, they have to adjust their expectations, change their requirements. It's all thanks to that global pandemic. We're spending the next hour on those advanced programs, taking your questions, your stories at 800-642-1234. Join the conversation here on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.